Well, hello and welcome to the Mariner's Library with me, Chris Stanmore-Major. In this episode, we're continuing the book In Broken Water by Adelard Coles. We're on Chapter 7, and this is the fifth part of the reading. And if you haven't already, please consider going over to patreon.com/themariner, and there for $5 a month you can help support this podcast and keep the information contained within these fantastic books easily available for the next generation. Now on with the story. Chapter 7, The Baltic Fjords. On Tuesday, July the 24th, Dunsterville and I got Annette underway at 10:15 a.m. We were bound for Copenhagen, a distance of about 250 miles, allowing for the roundabout way, cruising north along the coast of Jutland and then across the Little and Great Belts and up the east coast of Sealand. It was blowing a full gale and Mr. S said the weather was unfit for sailing and we should soon be back in harbour. However, the wind was westerly and thus offshore, so that we should have some protection from the land. We shortened sail to trysail and reefed foresail, for which we soon had to substitute the storm jib. Even so, not only was the lee deck continually awash, but at times the yacht was heeled so far that the cabin portholes were under water, which was a lot for such a beamy yacht. As soon as we got outside the shelter of Kiel Fjord, we had to cross over some banks and ran into a really dangerous breaking sea. I'd imagined that this part of the Baltic would be comparatively smooth, as it is partly sheltered by the Schleswig and Jutland mainland and by islands. But I soon learned otherwise. The Baltic is comparatively fresh water, and when it blows hard, the waves are short, steep, and confused. The day was one of the worst we experienced throughout the cruise, and I was in definite fear of our stem breaking clean off as Annette slammed heavily into the cross seas, blinding us with spray. It seemed impossible that it could hold together as it crashed into the hollows, hitting the seas as though they were pavement stones. Things were so bad that we had to alter course and beat for shelter into Ennica Fjord. When, at length, we got under the lee of the land, we found, in spite of constant pumping, that the cabin was half full of water, in which the kettle floated like a toy duck in a bath. Everything had shifted, even the lamp on gimbals had overturned. How different it all was in the fjord! Our anchorage was a delightful spot, with clean, transparent water protected by low, ragged cliffs, with a few houses in the background, almost hidden amongst the trees. After we had cleaned up, we rowed ashore, where we were not a little surprised to be confronted by a customs official who spoke English. He had not intercepted us for official reasons, but just to have a yarn, as he explained that he was very bored living in such lonely surroundings. We discussed politics, which seemed out of place on the peaceful evening, and afterwards strolled through the countryside. After this first experience of sailing in the Baltic, I felt rather doubtful as to whether we should ever make Copenhagen, as we were already behind time and had to return to England soon. Dunsterville, however, was very optimistic and staunchly refused to hear of giving up. So next day, we ran down Ennica Fjord under trysail and storm jib, and although the wind was still of gale force, we were protected from the west by the mainland as we sailed north. Our progress, with abeam wind and calm water, was splendid, and we averaged 7 knots between the Schley Fjord, which figures so much in the early part of the Riddle of the Sands, and Falshoft Head. By 1:15 p.m, however, the wind had shifted to northwest by west, which was a headwind across the open entrance of Flensborg Fjord, which here is about 10 miles wide. Once again we were thrashing to windward against the sea, and progress was so slow that we had had enough of it by the time we made Sonderburg at 5 o'clock. The customs came aboard, after which we were free to go ashore for provisions and to see a cinema. We were very pleased with this, our first impression of a Danish town. Sonderburg is a lovely little place, nestling under the high ground at the edge of the sound, which separates the Schleswig mainland from the island of Alsen and is spanned by a picturesque bridge. In the evening, we visited a cinema. It was a little difficult to follow the plots of the films, and all I remember was the frequency of the word og, which we gathered was Danish for and. Next day, it was fine, but still blowing hard, and we started at 9:30. We blew our foghorn violently as a signal for the bridge across the sound to open, and then sailed out of the town under reefed trysail and storm jib. The narrow channel of Alsund is one of the most beautiful of the Danish sounds. It is bordered with reeds and seaweed, and hemmed in on each side by high ground and woods. After sailing along 5 miles in this glorious scenery, the charm of which was enhanced by the bright sunny morning, We anchored, as we anticipated the sea in the wide part of Alsfjord would be bad. The afternoon was spent in writing letters and sleeping ashore under the pine trees, but in the evening we were able to get underway, the wind having fallen off, but almost immediately we ran aground. For 6 hours we worked hard trying to get a net off the sands, and whilst shifting ballast and heaving on the anchor chain, a thunderstorm passed, drenching us with rain and making the aspect of things appear even more gloomy, for it was a wild sunset, heavy with cloud, and even under the lee of the land the wind moaned with each strengthening gust. In the general excitement at nightfall, the dinghy got adrift, and the wind rapidly carried her out into the fjord. Every moment blew her further away, so I had to swim after her, and in my hurry got rather entangled with the long weeds that grow to the surface. Fortunately, the water was not as cold as the night air, and after recovering the boat and dressing again, I felt all the better for the plunge. We continued work until midnight, when, just as we were giving up hope, we succeeded in heaving her off the sands. We did it, inch by brute force. We dropped the anchor a long distance from the yacht, and to the end of the warp we set a six-fold tackle, and then we both heaved for all we were worth. We found in the Baltic that the wind usually moderates from about 4 to 9 o'clock, both morning and evening, so as it was blowing hard as ever the next day, I decided to wait until it might be expected to moderate a little. Accordingly, we started at 4:30 p.m. against a headwind, which on that particular day did not drop until later. Backwards and forwards we tacked across Alsfjord in cold, driving spray. There was not a great sea, but the waves were steep and tumbled aboard, stopping our way. It took us 5 hours to make 10 miles, and we were wet through and miserably cold before we had sailed 10 minutes. We had plenty of time, much too much in fact, to appreciate the scenery in which we were sailing. Fields ripe with corn, dark woods running down to the straggly cliffs, and the little, homely Danish cottages. The anchorage where we brought up at 9:30 p.m. was close to the shore under some trees. In Denmark, one does not have to worry about harbours, as protection from the west is usually all that is required. At night we simply used to feel our way with the lead close to the shore and let go. If the wind shifted to north or south, we could always run along the coast for shelter. The east rarely brings bad weather. I am told that summer in Denmark is usually fine, but we had nothing of the sort on our passage to Copenhagen. The weather was always squally, and the wind usually extreme, a calm or a gale, and bitterly cold. I felt the cold there more than when cruising in the Solent in March. Looking through the log, I see numerous notes, such as hard squalls from northwest, full gale of wind, rain and light east wind prevented further progress. In spite of these conditions, we both much enjoyed this part of the cruise. After our troubles in Germany, we felt free in Denmark and were, moreover, in wonderful cruising waters, where the sea is so broken up by islands that, however bad the weather, it is always possible to sail somewhere. Our passage took us across the Little Belt and eastward between Fayen and the little islands of Leo and Avernake, where Dunsterville had the misfortune on his watch to get half a mile off course, so that a net went aground on the only bank of sands in the vicinity, a mistake which is all too easy when there is only one man on deck to steer and navigate at the same time. This time we hauled a net off easily with a fourfold tackle and arrived off Svendborg safely at 2:15 p.m, where we spent the evening provisioning. The town did not strike us as very attractive, perhaps because it rained all the time while we were there. The sound and anchorage is generally regarded as a beautiful one. Chapter 8. Copenhagen at last. We left Svendborg the following afternoon, when the wind had moderated a little. I left the riding lamp alight in the forecastle in the hope that it would drive out some of the damp. Halfway across to Langeland, clouds of smoke came blowing out of the cabin. I dived below, thinking we were in for trouble, and found the lamp in flames. I got it on deck and put it out. The wick had been too high and had overheated the reservoir, making the whole thing flare up. The top of the lamp was red hot, and the rope attached to it was charred, so that the smoke was thick and sufficient to give the impression of a serious fire. That was not the only excitement of the day. It was rainy, thick weather, and having followed up the coast of Fayen, we set a compass course in the evening to the island of Langeland, which lay some miles to leeward. We had to find a channel giving 6 feet of water between two shoals. My chart was on a small scale, and two beacons were marked, and also a sounding of 1 meter. We found the sands right enough. but I discovered three beacons instead of the two, and as it was blowing hard and a tidy sea running, I did not care about coming round into the wind. We were running fast. I left the first beacon to starboard and ran straight at the second, leaving it 6 inches to starboard also. The waves foamed and broke. I saw the sand through the transparent sea coming higher and higher, and we knew we must hit. Then we were over, and the water smooth. When we brought a light to the chart, we found the beacon, which we had mistaken for a meter sounding. According to the chart, we had passed over in no water at all, but there is nearly always 6 feet of water close to a beacon or buoy, and I had counted on this when passing. We rounded the north of Langoland and dropped hook off the Hove lighthouse, where, although we were under the lee of the land, there was an unpleasant roll all night. July 30th was a record, being a really good day. We made sail at 8 a.m. and laid a course for Vero Island. We had to cross the banks off Oma, where the water is in places very shallow, and at the best only about 1.5 fathoms. As usual, the wind was very fresh and westerly. We could not have sailed had it been a headwind. We arrived at the banks and scanned the horizon for Vero, which I calculated upon picking up for obtaining a cross bearing. However, no Vero appeared, so we had to run south along the edge of the sands until we saw a beacon, where we took a short cross across the banks in the least depth of a fathom, according to our chart. The sea was transparent, as usual, and it was very exciting work watching the bed of the sea, sometimes getting nearer and nearer, and sometimes further and further. We passed over clean sands, rocks and weed, with about 2 feet to spare. The waves were not very large, fortunately, as if they had been our chances of crossing without touching would have been reduced. There is no tide in the Baltic, but the wind banks up the water on the shores to which it is blowing, and correspondingly reduces it elsewhere. This makes hard currents in narrow channels, and also causes uncertainty with regard to depth. There may be less water than marked on the chart, or, on the other hand, there may be more, so that if one runs aground and the wind shifts, taking the water with it, one may be left there for a month or a year. Consequently, we had to be careful, and, if we had been cautious, should have avoided depths of under 7 feet when sailing in open water. We passed Masnado Island at 3 p.m. after averaging 6 knots for 3 hours. The complicated Ulv Sound lay before us, where we had been advised to take a pilot, as 6 feet is the greatest depth of water. We reduced canvas in order to sail slowly and felt our way with the lead. The Ulvsund is a sheltered sea which separates Sealand from the islands of Laland, Falster and Moen, which lie to the south, and it bears some resemblance to Spithead in the Solent. The luxuriant shores and the little islands between which fishing boats and yachts wind their complicated courses make the scene very beautiful on a fine day, but the navigation there is intricate, as the seabed is very irregular and the channel not very clearly marked. The first part is not so bad, as it is in more constant use and there are plenty of beacons, but the last half has only a few leading marks, and, as it was dusk, we could not see them until we were close up. I shortened sail and gave the helm to Dunsterville, and Annette drifted slowly forward while I stood watching the water. We ran on our course wherever possible, but when I saw we were about to run aground, I shouted and Dunsterville luffed until it was possible to carry on again. In this way, we found a passage through the sands and boulders, until at length we found the most important beacons. Here, disaster nearly occurred. We overtook a barge, and not believing in unnecessary work, I adopted our late pilot's method of following. The water looked very shallow, and I noticed 2 beacons to starboard and suddenly realised that between those beacons lay the channel where we should have been, with its maximum depth of 6 feet. I immediately rounded up and got right, after which we easily ran on until we dropped anchor at 9 p.m. under a lighthouse. The barge probably drew only 3 feet of water, and our escape from running aground must have been narrow. Not that it would have mattered, for we were sailing slowly in protected water. Next day, July the 31st, was a great occasion for us as we arrived at Copenhagen. We had left our anchorage at 4 a.m. The wind was southerly, so it was fair, but unfortunately it was also light, so we did not sail as fast as we should have liked, and it was not until 2 p.m. that we temporarily picked up a mooring outside the yacht haven at Copenhagen. It was raining in torrents, but calm, and we towed Annette with the dinghy into the yacht basin. This is small and completely protected from the roll set up by passing steamers in the outer harbour. Yachts berth alongside each other, stem to a mooring and stern to the quay, so that one can step ashore. A Danish yachtsman, Mr. Danielson, directed us to a vacant gap alongside a Finnish racing yacht named Tarpon 2. Mr. Danielson did not stop at just showing us in. He also took us to dinner at his club, the Amateur Sailing Club. The clubhouse is an old Greenland whaler, moored off the yacht harbour. The mess is particularly attractive, with the walls covered with pictures of yachts and ships, past and present. After dinner, we went to see the Tivoli, the famous amusement park. It is a kind of glorified fair. On entering, one faces a wide and crowded stone-paved path, which is lit by coloured lights overhead and by the glare of the city. To the left is an open-air theatre with classical dancing. Good music on one side vies with jazz on the other. The latter is more popular, and there are three open-air jazz bands, not to speak of the orchestras in the dance halls and merry-go-rounds. There is music of one sort or another everywhere. Cafes, restaurants, booths, fireworks, swings, railways vie with each other to attract attention, and on a fine evening, all are crowded. The place seems French in conception, but the people more like the English. We remained at Copenhagen for 5 days and thoroughly enjoyed our visit. Both the Royal Danish Yacht Club and the Amateur Sailing Club extended their hospitality to us, and we had all our meals ashore at the clubs. Mr. Danielson showed us round Copenhagen. He was a professional photographer and took us to his studio, where our picture was duly taken, attired in yachting caps and oilskins and gravely scanning a chart, with appropriate studio background. Not mermaids, though. We also met the owner of Tarpon 2, a Viking of a man who showed us over his yacht, a lovely craft with varnished mahogany topsides and laid decks, which was so well kept by the paid hand that she put a net to shame. We also enjoyed seeing the Danish yachts in the basin. Many of the cruisers were double-enders, which I liked, and some were for sale at moderate prices. Copenhagen is a beautiful city, clean and clear-cut under the northern sky. Built on the edge of the Sound, facing Sweden, it is a maritime town, but without any of the dirt and slums which are so often associated with great ports. We should have liked to stay there for a while, but time was pressing, and I was kept busy answering our mail and getting a net ready for a rough passage when homeward bound against the prevailing winds. I had the trysail reduced in size and wrote to Heikendorf saying I should shortly be putting in there for the new mast I had ordered. A new Excelsior log was waiting for us, as when we were at Kiel, I had wired to Tillings for a new one. Chapter 9. Back to Kiel. All too soon arrived the day of departure from Copenhagen. We were reluctant to leave, but it is one thing to sail from England to Denmark, and quite another to get back again against the prevailing winds. We had to allow plenty of time for beating into headwinds, so on August the 5th, we bade farewell to our friends and got underway at midday. We decided to sail back to Kiel by a different route, coasting south along Sealand, Moen and Falster, to enable us to see more of Denmark, and thence to the German coast, past the island of Fehmarn to Kiel Bay. The barometer was rising and there was a nice west-northwest wind. We passed Sven's Head, 30 miles to the south, at about 5 p.m, and by 11:30 p.m. we had covered another 25 miles and lay off Moen Head, more or less becalmed. So we hove to on the starboard tack for the night and turned in for sleep that was disturbed occasionally when I had to put my head on deck to see how things were going. At 4 o'clock next morning, the wind was still very light and thick white mist had come down, so we did not sail until 6 o'clock when we put her on the port tack and headed for land. Presently, something like great white mountains of snow appeared above the fog, which we soon realised were the cliffs by Moen Head, with the sun on the crest and enveloped below with mist. It was a striking sight. The wind was very light and variable, so the whole day's sail only brought us to Heims Bay, a run of 10 miles. We anchored in the entrance to the Gronsnund, the sound between the islands of Moen and Falster, where we found a strong current running. The scene was very beautiful in the evening, when the sun set behind the wooded shore, and the clear water ran quietly past, so clear that we could see the curve of our chain and the anchor itself embedded in the sand. Everything was wonderfully peaceful, and the weather perfect. All the following day, conditions were the same. light winds, but mainly southeast and a sunny sky. We slowly coasted southward a few hundred yards offshore, watching the ever-changing scene, high cliffs, low cliffs, and wood. We made Gedser Point, the southern point of Denmark, at 5:45 p.m., and having had an easy day, we sailed straight on all night for Fehmarn Island, which is German. The night sailing was rather exciting, as the wind freshened from the southwest and we were soon thrashing into a nasty head sea. It was intensely dark, and the only warnings that enabled us to reduce slamming were the sound of the hissing waves and the glow of their breaking crests. Annette did not like the Baltic, and though only a wholesale breeze was blowing, she slammed and fretted and made a tremendous fuss in the steep sea. The vibration and noise were too much to allow us any sleep when off watch, and we were very glad to pick up Stala Head Light and get under shelter of Fehmarn Island. We sailed through the channel between the island and the German coast, and as the wind moderated at dawn, we were able to make better progress, though we still had a headwind and had to continue tacking. The distance from Fehmarn to Kiel Fjord is nearly 40 miles, which took us most of the day. In Kiel Bay, a smart squall struck us and the port main shroud parted. I rushed forward, lowered the peak and furled the jib. This eased her a little, but the mast was bending like a bow and might at any moment break. Two seas followed each other in quick succession, and things were very exciting for a few minutes whilst I was reefing. When snugged down, we got way on again, but twice were prevented coming about by big waves. The third attempt was successful, but I shall never forget the sight of our mast bending and twisting like the letter S and yet not breaking. Once on the other tack, we soon put things right by lashing a block to the broken stay and setting it up with a tackle. I should, of course, have thrown the yacht on the other tack the instant I heard the shroud break. Shortly afterwards, the wind shifted towards the south, so as to blow straight out of Kiel Fjord and delay us further, which was not a little annoying, as nightfall was then on us and there was no moon. We had a somewhat thrilling time entering in the midst of German naval manoeuvres. Guns were firing and searchlights blazing. A destroyer came quite near and fixed her searchlight on us. It was useful to read the chart by, but I hoped there was nothing very important going on that we were disturbing. In the year following, 1924, papers made a great fuss about the first German manoeuvres since the war, but we noticed in 1923 that the Navy was by no means dead, and at Cuxhaven, sentries were on duty at the batteries, which were made conspicuous by the number of notices threatening would-be photographers. It was very dark, and as we entered Kiel Fjord, some large barges slipped close past us, their sails hardly discernible against the sky. By midnight, we had managed to find our way into the unlit cove of Heikendorf and anchored off the yacht yard. Early next morning, we were warped under the shipbuilder's crane and our mast lifted out. When it was carried ashore, it was found that the new mast they had made for us was a foot too short, so a delay of 3 days was incurred whilst they made another new one. Among the letters for us, we were glad to find one from Mr. S., the German who had helped us before. He said he had been in the Ingrid as far as Heligoland, where they had been weather-bound for some days, and in consequence of this, and as the Ingrid had already been much delayed whilst fitting out, the limited time at the disposal of most of her crew, who were on their summer holidays, had run out. Mr. S. had returned to Kiel and another man to England, leaving only Jolly and Buster on board. As the Ingrid was a yacht of 15 tons TM, at the time somewhat under-ballasted in relation to her large spread of canvas, it seemed rather a tall order for two men to take her to England. I felt a little anxious for them, as the weather had been bad and most of Ingrid's standing rigging was on the light side, according to British standards. We had many things to attend to, so for the moderate fee of one halfpenny, I telegraphed to Mr. S., and he came over from Kiel by the next steamer to see us. We arranged to meet him the following morning, when he would be free to help us with provisioning and other matters. The usual German business working hours appear to be from 5 a.m. to 2:30 p.m., rather a good arrangement in summer, when it leaves the whole afternoon and evening for leisure. The whole morning before meeting him was spent in visiting banks. The mark had gone quickly from 15 to 20 millions to the pound. It had been only 800,000 when we had left Germany. The printers had struck simultaneously with this latest collapse, thus causing a grave shortage of paper money. We could not get a pound changed anywhere in Kiel, and at the largest bank, they had not the money to spare to change a Danish 1 kroner note, value 10 shillings. The shops were still open, but nobody could buy anything. However, in the afternoon, Mr. S got a note changed through a friend of a friend in a bank. The printers had resumed work. Our shopping that day was a great success, as prices were low and Mr. S did all the bargaining for us, whilst we kept quiet. If we had said a word, they would have noticed we were English and charged us more. We bought our bread at Heikendorf from a baker who spoke English. On one occasion, he asked me into his back room, and we had quite an interesting talk. It appeared that he had been interned during the war, having had a baker's shop in Hull. After the war, he went back to Germany, and since then had not done very well. Recently, he said things had been impossible. He had made good profit on his bread and cakes, yet when he had to buy flour, he found the price had gone up more than his profits. He went on to say that the great trouble in Germany since the war had been lack of religion. He had shortly before asked me a pound for 6 shillings worth of provisions. Kiel and the surrounding country he declared to be the worst part of Germany for socialism, and then he went to the old, old subject, cursing France. The average German seemed incapable of understanding why England did not interfere in the Ruhr, and shrugged his shoulders when one pointed out that France was an ally. "But your trade, your unemployment, it suffers too, no?" etc., etc. Well, that's all for today. I hope you're enjoying the story so far. The next instalment will be available in the Mariner's Library shortly, and remember, of course, you've got all the content over on YouTube and the Mariner podcast, and of course Patreon at patreon.com/themariner. But for now, wherever you are and whatever you're doing, I hope that you're safe and sound, and I look forward to speaking to you in the next one. Cheers.